We are up to the ninth parak of Mishlei tonight. We've got some interesting, some oldies but goodies, some new ideas from some familiar faces, and of course some new angles on the same concepts that Mishlei oftentimes talks about, which is the motivation to engage with the Torah. And in many ways, some explain that the ninth parak is in some ways a review of Prakim 7 and 8. If you remember, Prakim 7 and 8 were a lot about, if you remember before, it was first about the woman who seduced the young man and what that represents in terms of the person who's swayed after their desires. And then we also talked about the creation of the world and how the Torah is the blueprint of the world. So we talked a lot about that. So those are just some of the themes that we'll see come up again, but in different words and in different messages. So let's jump in here. If you have the sheet, that's good. If you don't have the sheet, that's also good. We will go through it line by line. We are in the beginning of Perek Tes, chapter 9 of Mishlei, of Proverbs, of Shlomo HaMelech. Shlomo HaMelech says, Chachmos ban sabesa. What does that mean? Chachmos ban sabesa. Which is somewhat poetic, the alliteration. He does it a couple times in the Pesukim, we'll say it tonight, a few times. So he says, and here you can see it in the English, wisdom has built her house. What does it mean, wisdom has built her house? So it's basically explaining in first explicit terms when it says chachmos, and then it says she's built her house, meaning she's all set up, right? She's got it all set up. Chatzva amudeha shiva. And she has hewn her seven pillars. So what does that mean? So first of all, there is a three-way machlokas as to how to understand what the metaphor is referring to here. She's built a house. Well, what's the house built upon, or what's it built for? So Rashi, if you look at Rashi in the second source or on the pasuk, so Rashi tells us bechachma bana kadosh baruch hu es haolam, that it's with wisdom that Hashem created the world. We've seen this before, right? That Hashem explained that the world was created on the foundation of Torah. We talked about what that means in terms of moral philosophies, in terms of ethics, and understanding how the world is really an expression of the Torah, as opposed to the Torah being a guide for how to deal with the world. The world is really a guide of how to live out the Torah, which is in some ways, you know, the same thing, but in other ways, it's just a different way of looking at it. It has some interesting ramifications, as we spoke about probably a month ago now. Then Rashi continues, Chatzva Amudeha Shiva. Now this is where a lot of the Mefarshim have to deal with. What does the number seven mean? Now, whatever metaphor you're going to give, it has to mean something, because it's a very specific number, right? As we know in Judaism, there are a lot of significant sevens, right? You have the 7 days of the week, you have the 7 days of the holidays, you have the 7 weeks of Svira, you have the 7 years of Shemitah, you have the seven cycles of seven, which creates the Sefirah HaOmer. Then you have the whole seven cycles of the seven Shemitahs, which is Yovel. So the number seven is a very specific word. So what exactly is it trying to portray? When the Pasuk, when Shlomo HaMelech says that she built her house and she made her seven pillars, what are these seven pillars referring to? So Rashi tells us it's referring to the first seven of the world. Shiva Simei Bereshis, the 7 days of creation. Comes Rashi and says, you know, it also might be referring to something else. Which is, and that, by the way, the 7 days of creation lines up very nicely with his first statement, that this Chachmos Ban Sabesa, that the house was built, is referring to the world. That Hashem created the world with wisdom. But comes Rashi and says, you know, there might be another aspect to this. There might be another reason as to why we're talking about the number seven. And that is, based on the Gemara that we're about to see, let's just look at it in the Gemara. The Gemara tells us in Shabbos Daf, Kuf Tes Zayin, Amud Aleph, 116a, Keman Azla Hada Amar Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmeni Amar Rabbi Yonasan Chatzva Amudei HaShiva Elu Shiva Sifrei Torah. There are seven Torahs. Seven Torahs. How in the world are there seven Torahs? None of the attendees tonight are in the Daf Yomi Shir, which is wonderful. I love the fact that we have different people at different shirim. It's beautiful. But anyone who is in Daf Yomi might be familiar with this Gemara, because we learned it about 2 months ago. A month and a half ago. What it's referring to is the halachas of Sifrei Torah in terms of what is considered the smallest significant piece of Torah. Now, if I were to ask you, what does it mean, the small, significant piece of Torah? You'd probably tell me, well, what has Kedusha? What's considered holy? And I'd say, well, what does it mean, what's holy? So then you might tell me, well, it's referring to what has to go in Shemos. What has to be put inside of Shemos. Now, that's only partially true, because there are a lot more things besides just the Torah that go into Shemos. But one of the things that's important for the Gemara to figure out is, what are you allowed to save in a fire? That might sound strange to you. What are you allowed to save in a fire? Let's say it's a Shabbos afternoon, and Chas v'Shalom, there's a fire somewhere, and you have to save stuff. So the truth is, we're not going to let you put out the fire. We're also not going to let you busy yourself in our room trying to save all these things, lest you want to put out the fire on Shabbos when it's unnecessary to. That sounds somewhat harsh, and it depends on the situation, and depends who you can get to do it, etc. But one of the questions the Gemara asks is, well, what's the minimum amount of a holy piece of Torah? And the Gemara concludes, or at least one of the opinions is, that the minimum amount, I believe, is 85 letters. 85 letters written on a Sefer Torah is significant enough that you'd be allowed to save it on Shabbos. Where do we get 85 letters from? Does anyone know? 85 letters. 85 letters comes from a very specific part of the Torah, which is bracketed off. Now, maybe people are familiar already with what I'm saying. It's Vayihi ben Soharon. When we take the Torah out, those psukim, or that pasuk, those two psukim there, are considered one Torah unto themselves. And therefore, says the Gemara, we learn from there that that's itself a Torah, because it's bracketed off, it's sectioned off, it's as if it's its own Sefer. We have Bereshis, we have Shmos, we have Vayikra, we have Bamidbar number 1, we have Vayihi ben Soharon, and then we have Bamidbar number 2, which is after Vayihi ben Soharon, and then we have Devarim. And what does that get you? That gets you 7 books. Now, Vayihi ben Soharon is a very small book, but it's a book nonetheless, according to the Gemara, and that's what Rashi tells us here, quoting from the Gemara in Shabbos, that this is what it means when the Pasuk says, Chatzva Amudei HaShiva, that the Torah is made up of 7 books, and that is the foundation of the house. The foundation of the entire world is those 7 books of the Torah. Ah, now we have Michael Barish. He knows that Gemara well, that there are 7 books of the Torah, and that's learned out from this first pasuk of chapter 9 in Mishlei. So that's analogy or metaphor number 2. Metaphor number 1 was that it was created, it was the world. Metaphor number 2 was that it's referring to the Torah. So now we're going to get to metaphor number 3, which is from the Ralbag. The Ralbag says the following. Chachmos bansa besa, that wisdom created her house. Hine hatzavuna bansa besa. Wisdom, or understanding, I should say, maybe intuition, built her house. Bechachmos. Wisdom builds her house with, intuition builds her house with wisdom. What does that mean? Ki hasagas hachachmos kodemes lahasagas habina. He's saying it's not talking about the world per se, and it's not talking about the Torah per se. It's talking about the notion of wisdom. The notion of intuition is building her house with wisdom, with knowledge, I should say. Chachma is wisdom. Hard to translate these words into English. We've talked about that before. So why? Ki hasagas hachachmos kodemes hasagas habina. The understanding of wisdom, or I would say knowledge, comes before the understanding of intuition, or the hasaga is really the seizing of, or the capture of. Well, hasig is to finally grab hold of something. It's like I'm thinking of a word. I can't think of it now. But that's what he says it means. V'sam chatzva amudei shiva. So according to the Ralbag, where we're not talking about the world, which is the days of creation, could be 7. And we're not talking about the Torah, which its books can be 7. But instead we're talking about the concept of knowledge and the concept of intuition. So what does the number 7 have to do with anything? Says the Ralbag, Rotze lomar chachamos rabos. The number 7, as we even say in English, we say the word several, right? Seems to be connected to the number 7, but it doesn't mean 7. It just means a bunch. So says the Ralbag, here when it says, Chachma Chatzva Amudei HaShiva, she created 7 pillars. What it means is there are a lot of pillars to wisdom. Wisdom has a lot of pillars that create intuition, that create understanding. in order to actually understand something, to really have an intuition about it, you have to really understand a lot of, you have to have a lot, you have to amass a lot of knowledge. So it's Kimisbar Shiva Yomar Al Hariboy. There's another pasuk that we have in Mishle that says, Kisheva Yipol Tzadik Vikam. A person falls down seven, a tzadik falls down seven times and gets up. What does it mean? A tzadik can only fall down seven times and get up. What if he falls down or she falls down six times? What if she or he falls down nine times, 10 times, 100 times? So then it's not, they're not a tzadik or not a tzadikas anymore. What does that mean, seven? So he says, no, seven is just a word of exaggeration. It means a lot, like the word several. So says the Ralbag, in the third metaphor we'll see to understand this psukim, that it's referring to the character traits or the abilities, intellectual capacities of a person. Number one, you need chachmos. There are a lot of chachmos in the world, a lot of things to know, a lot of raw material. And from that raw material, you have tivuna. Tivuna is understanding or intuition. And this is something that I think we've definitely spoken about before. I'm not sure how long ago it was, but it comes to an interesting point that Malcolm Gladwell makes in his book called Blink. But I'll quote from a different part of the book in order to make it sound like we haven't said it yet, because we haven't said this part of the book yet. Either way, so the book says the following. Malcolm Gladwell says, there was a man named Gary Klein, and he ran a consulting firm in Ohio, and he wrote a book called Sources of Power, which is one of the classic works on decision-making. Klein studied nurses, intensive care units, firefighters, and other people who make decisions under pressure. And one of his conclusions is that when experts make decisions, they don't logically and systematically compare all available options. You can imagine in the heat of the moment, if a firefighter is sort of opening the books, opening up a textbook, deciding what decision to make, he doesn't have that kind of time. He's got to put out the fire, right? He has to have instincts that can deal with that situation. That is the way people are taught to make decisions. Meaning when you have to make a decision, you sit down, you make your pros list, you make your cons list, you compare and contrast them, and you say, okay, what am I going to do? But these professions, you can't do that. In real life, it is too much, it is much too slow. Klein's nurses, firefighters would size up a situation almost immediately and act, drawing on experience and intuition and a kind of rough mental simulation. To Van Reaper, who he was talking about before in a different sort of military situation, that seemed to describe much more accurately how people make decisions on the battlefield, right? When you're at a time of war, especially guerrilla warfare, you can't sit there strategizing when you're in the throes of battle, right? You're in the battlefield, you got to make quick decisions or else you're going to be killed. Like a few pages later, he says the following about a very interesting concept about improv. Right, we think of improv, which is sort of like comedic sketches. We think that improv is somewhat of a off the cuff. Right, these people are just brilliant. They have a sort of a knack for comedy, and that's how they're able to come up with all that stuff. Right, anyone who's familiar with the classic show Whose Line Is It Anyway? That's improv. Right, thinking of things right on the spot. Some of them are better than others. So how are they able to do that? What kind of thing? So he says, but the truth is that improv isn't random and chaotic at all. They aren't all the sort of zany, impulsive, free-spirited comedians that you might imagine them to be. Some are quite serious, even nerdy. He's talking about a specific group he knows that did a thing called Mother. I think the group was called Mother. Every week they get together for a lengthy rehearsal. After each show, they gather backstage and critique each other's performance soberly. Why did they practice so much? Because improv is an art form governed by a series of rules, and they want to make sure that when they're on stage, everyone abides by those rules. We think of what we're doing as a lot like basketball. It's an intricate, high-speed game filled with split-second spontaneous decisions. But that spontaneity is possible only when everyone first engages in hours of highly repetitive and structured practice, perfecting their shooting, dribbling, and passing and running plays over and over again, and agrees to play a carefully defined role on the court. This is the critical lesson of improv too. Spontaneity is not random. And this is what I think of when I think of this Ralbag and his way of understanding the pasuk. Chachmos ban sabesa, that wisdom is going to build its house. How is wisdom going to build the house? Chatzva amudea shiva. It's going to sort of entrench all of the the wisdom as the foundation of the house, and then afterwards it's going to bring tivunah, it's going to bring understanding or intuition. You have to amass a large swath of wisdom, of knowledge, to really understand the intuitive process of decision making. And this is true with the Torah too. You can't just make decisions because you went to a third grade Chumash class. You have to keep learning. We're all continuing to learn. You have to keep learning Mishle, and you learn Gemara, and you learn Halacha, and you learn all these different things over and over and over again, so that when the time comes, you'll be able to properly use them to your advantage with your intuition. We've talked about before the parable. I think it was one of our first classes we talked about. An analogy brought up in what book was that? I'm trying to think. Maybe it was Blink also. I don't remember exactly. No, I don't think it was Blink. It was a different book. I forgot what book it is. But either way, we had a metaphor we once said from a math teacher. The math teacher asked his students used to ask him, why do we need to know math? Well, I'm going to get a calculator anyway, right? Why do I after basic addition and subtraction, what's the benefit of math? So he said, well, let me ask you. He was talking to a high schooler. He said, well, let me ask you, do you ever lift weights? So the kid said, yeah, I lift weights I go to the gym all the time. So the teacher says, well, are you expecting to be encountered by a big barbell someday? Why would you need to lift weights? You have to learn how to punch. You have to learn how to fend off an animal or something. Why would you ever need to lift barbells? How is that going to come in handy? So he says the same thing is true by math. When it comes to math, you don't do math so that you can understand when the time comes, so you can understand geometry, so that you can understand algebra or calculus too. The reason you learn math is to work out your intellectual muscles, to make sure that whatever you're doing is something which promotes the circuitry in your brain. And the more you learn, the more it's going to create a certain intuition, a certain strength to your neural transmitters, and that's going to help you think better. And lahavdil, but the same way, the wisdom and intuition of the Torah is the same. The more you learn, the more you're working out that moral ethic, that moral compass that you're creating through understanding the Torah. That's creating the decision making that you can build upon with your by creating intuition. This is also something I think about when I think about Daf Yomi. Sometimes people ask, especially younger guys, you know, how do I get good at learning Gemara? Right, Gemara is not an easy thing to pick up. It's not like reading a textbook. It has its own language. It has its own rhythm and interpretations. But it's very hard, and it's also not even, it might be using Hebrew letters, but it's not in Hebrew. At least most of it's not. It's mainly in Aramaic. At least the colloquial stuff is Aramaic. So how do you learn how to learn Gemara? So I always tell them the same thing. I say there are other things you can use, like structures. You can use tricks of the trade. But the best way to learn Gemara is to learn Gemara. Just learn as much of it as you can. Just keep learning and learning and learning, breaking your teeth like a language. The best way to learn a language is not through phonics, although I'm sure that's a good structural way. But the best way to learn it is try to speak it. Whip out a dictionary, try to put sentences together, break your teeth over it, and sooner or later you'll figure out the rhythms, you'll figure out the different ways the grammar works, and you'll figure out how to speak. Same thing is true with Gemara, and the same thing is true with Torah and with halacha. Well, not necessarily halacha in terms of deciding halacha, but halacha in terms of acting it out. The more you learn, the better not only your knowledge becomes, but also your intuition for its application. And that's what the Ra'abag is saying here. Chachmos bansabesa, that wisdom is the foundation of understanding and creating that Torah intuition that we're all hoping for. The next pasuk, continuing that, says, well, she's built a house. What else is she doing? Right, wisdom built the house. What else is she doing? Tivcha, tivcha, tavcha, tivcha, mischa yena, af archa shulchana. She has prepared the feast. She's mixed the wine. Tevach literally means to slaughter like an animal. She's prepared the meat. She's prepared the wine, and she even set the table. Af archa shulchana, meaning the Torah is all out there. What are these referring to? So the Malbim explains that these are exactly what we're talking about before. They're talking about the different types of understanding. So the Malbim explains, for those who have it, you can see it but I'll say it outside. Shahasa Uda Asher Hechina Likro Eha, the feast that she's prepared for those she's calling to invite. Male Koltuv, it is free, it's full of wonderful things. Vinasa Begaloi Ulein Kol, and it's made and revealed and expressed to everyone who wants it. Shetavcha Tevach, she's made the feed, Vahachin Mascha Yain, she's made the wine. Vial Pi Hamalitza, what does this mean? What's the metaphor? Hachachma Hi Mazon Hanefesh, wisdom and knowledge is the sustenance of a person's soul. You need it to churn out whatever nutrients you need. It is the sort of like the sustenance of your body. Umesicha hayayin romez ledivrei havina. And the mixing of the wine is referring to the intellect, referring to the intuition that we just spoke about, the understanding. Why is the intellect or the intuition referred to as wine? Shehayayin mesameach es halev. Because wine gladdens the heart. Vinase oso, and it sort of uplifts him. V'chein habina, and similarly when it comes to intuition, when you understand something, yotzi'ehu lahavin davar midavar ulaharchiv ruach binaso, you're expanding the spirit of your understanding. And there's a certain satisfaction, a certain joy and pleasure that a person gets when they understand something new. I don't know if people are familiar with this concept, but hopefully you've experienced it one way or another. When you learn something, hopefully in Torah or in Halacha or something which is particularly meaningful to you, but even other things, when you finally chop something, when you finally figure something out, right? When you learn, you're studying, oh, now I get it. Now it makes sense to me. Now I can take and I can apply it to other things. It sort of clicks, right? There's a certain enjoyment, a certain pleasure in that. Right, if anyone's really worked hard and trying to understand something, and then finally is able to understand it, so you understand, you might know what that means. But it says the Malbim, that's what it means when you have bina. That's why bina, this intuition, this understanding, is compared to wine, because on the one hand, wisdom, you have to just eat it up, right? That's the sustenance of the soul. You got to get your basics in, and that's your studying, that's your research. That's when you delve into the books, try to figure out as much as you can. But the wine, that's the enjoyable part where you finally get it, where you finally understand it. A beautiful message from the Malbim, which I think also can teach us a lot about the process of learning. Because oftentimes we think that learning is something which is instantaneous, especially in the 21st century. You want to know something? You just Google it, right? You just, you ask Siri. Siri, what is this? What is that? Siri will tell you the information. The question is, do I really have to work at it? And honestly, I don't want to go into a diatribe now, but honestly, I think this is sorely lacking in our generation because it used to be in yesteryear, maybe some people here are familiar with this concept. If you wanted to learn something, you had to trek to the library, right? Didn't matter if it was snowing outside, didn't matter if it was raining. You had to get off, you had to put your shoes on, you had to walk down the street, you have to open the door, you have to find the book, you have to open the book, then you have to sift through the book to find where you need to know, and then you have to read the whole chapter to figure out what you want to know. Nowadays, what's involved in learning? Instantaneous. Just type it into Google, ask Siri, she'll figure it out right away. And that's, in some ways, a wonderful thing. In some ways, it cuts out a lot of the technicalities, and it cuts out a lot of the effort and saves a lot of time. But at the same time, it also makes a person think that in order to acquire wisdom, you don't have to put a lot of effort in. And that's not true. To acquire wisdom, to really have, develop this intuition, you have to really put in the work. You have to do a lot of the work. And sometimes because we're not necessarily geared to that, at least the younger generations aren't always geared to that. Now, be that as it may, Orthodox Jews who have an emphasis on Torah, so there's only so much Google can do for you. You got to open up the books. There's no other way to do it. You got to listen to a shir. But for others who don't necessarily have that upbringing, or who don't have that background, or don't have that ability, so for them, we oftentimes think it's too hard to learn. It's too hard to research. It's too hard to put the work in. But the truth is that if you really value something, if something's very important, like the Torah should be, so then not only is it not, it, not only will it give you a positive dividend in the end of the day, not only will it be pleasurable like wine, as the Malbim is saying here, it'll be pleasurable like wine in the end of the day, but when that's the process, so that process itself is rewarding. And this reminded me of a piece that I've talked about. I think I quoted this part of this piece in a drasha once last year. Don't ask me to remember or figure out when I said it because I don't remember. But this is from a book I've quoted a few times called Grit by Angela Duckworth. And here, for those baseball fans, she's talking about a Hall of Fame pitcher named Tom Seaver. Not sure if anyone here is familiar with baseball enough to know Tom Seaver. Well, Ron's here, and I'm sure some people are familiar just because he was a very well-renowned pitcher. So Tom Seaver, was he on the Mets?
I believe so.
I was thinking Orioles, but could be. I don't remember. You might remember better than I do. But Tom Seaver, Hall of Fame pitcher, he's in the record books. I don't think he owns many records. He's not like the top of the list, just by sheer length of how long the game's been played. But he's in the record books. Great Hall of Fame pitcher. And he said the following about his life. Seaver aimed to pitch the best I possibly can, day after day, year after year. Pitching determines what I eat, when I go to bed, what I do when I'm awake. It determines how I spend my life when I'm not pitching. If it means I have to come to Florida and can't get tanned because I might get a burn, that would keep me from throwing for a few days, and I know that I never go shirtless in the sun. If it means I have to remind myself to pet dogs with my left hand or throw logs in the fire with my left hand, then I do that too. If it means in the winter I eat cottage cheese instead of chocolate chip cookies in order to keep my weight down, then I eat cottage cheese. The life Seaver described sounds grim, but that's not how Seaver saw things. Pitching is what makes me happy. I've devoted my life to it. I've made up my mind that's what I want to do. I'm happy when I pitch well, so I only do things that help me be happy. What I mean, this is Duckworth talking now, what I mean by passion is not just that you have something you care about. What I mean is that you care about that same ultimate goal in an abiding, loyal, steady way. You are not just that you have something you care, you are not capricious. Each day you wake up thinking of the questions you fell asleep thinking about. You are, in a sense, pointing the same direction. Ever eager to take even the smallest step forward than to take a step to the side towards some other destination. Your actions derive their significance from their allegiance to your ultimate concern, your life philosophy. You have your priorities in order. This is how she quotes and describes Tom Seaver's outlook on life. It's true. If you look at Tom Seaver's daily routine, some people might say, oh, it's so unfortunate. You have to think about what hand to pet your dog with. You have to think about what types of food you eat. You can't indulge the same way you would like to. So to Tom Seaver, it wasn't such a bad reality. Because for him, he knew that on this trajectory, I'm going to fulfill my life's mission. My mission statement of being a good pitcher. Now, obviously, as Orthodox Jews, we have loftier goals than pitching a baseball. But for Tom Seaver, that was his goal. And Lahavda, we can learn from that. When it comes from, whereas the pasuk says, when Yaakov meets up with Esav, so it says im lavan garti, right? And Rashi says, tarag miso shamarti v'lo lomadati m'masav harayim. He sends to Esav. He sends a message. I lived with Lavan a long time, and I kept all the mitzvos. And then he says, and I didn't learn from his ways. From his bad ways. So there are many different ways of understanding this. But one interpretation that I always think about is, while it's true, Lavan was a Rasha, Yaakov could have learned from him, right? Lo lamadate ma'asav harayim means, I kept all the mitzvos, but I didn't learn from how passionate Lavan was to do the wrong things. Meaning, even if someone does a different thing that doesn't have the value that we have, we can still learn from how they do it. So here too, Lahavdil Tom Seaver is also teaching us a very valuable lesson in the values, how we sort of act in life, how we go about the journey towards the values that we care about. And when I see this Malbim, I talk about, when you see this pasuk, Tevcha, Tivcha, Michseyena, so you have to make the food, You have to actually eat the bread, which is the wisdom, and ultimately you're going to get your wine. Ultimately, you're going to get to that pleasure, to that thing you're working for. The more halacha you learn, the more Torah you learn, the more you know, the more you listen to teachers and parents and people that are giving you guidance, the easier and more pleasurable it will be at the end when you finally reach your mission, when you accomplish part of your mission of being an upstanding Torah Jew. And that will give you pleasure like wine. And that's what Shlomo Melech is talking about according to the Mabon. But now let's keep going with this analogy. Shalchana Rosea Tikra, she sends out her young maids to announce Tikra, to speak. Algabe Meirome Karas. Now this is interesting. On the heights of the town, right? So it's unclear what Karas means, but presumably it means the town, like Kiryah Ne'emana, as we said in Echa, is a trustworthy city or a respected city. So what does that mean? She sends out her young maids. So who are these young maids? So again, we have to look back at the original metaphor. According to Rashi, the metaphor could have been two different things. It could have been the creation of the world, or it could have been the Torah. So says Rashi, who are the maidservants? Who are the maids that are being sent out? Number one, it could be, according to the creation of the world, Adam and Chava. Those are the two maidservants that are sort of talking about the creation of the world. Number two, if it's talking about the Torah, it could be referring to Moshe and Aaron. Right? Moshe and Aaron, the ones who were to teach the Jewish people about the Torah. Says the Malbim, what does it mean? She sends out the maids. Very interesting. You know, it doesn't say that the Torah, we've talked about this before, it doesn't say that the Torah tries to convince anyone. Now, the Torah does have what to say. And we've seen in previous chapters that Shlomo Malch tells us what the Torah has to say. But here, the Torah is not sending out missionaries. Right? The Jewish people don't have missionaries. And the Torah doesn't believe that everybody needs to believe it or needs to follow all 613 mitzvot. If you're not Jewish, so you have a different role in the world, right? But what is true is that there are people that keep the Torah, that have an obligation to live by the Torah, and who exemplify what it means to live by the Torah. And through their living, they bring other people who also should be keeping the Torah. They bring them back, or in the first place, to the Torah. So the Malbim says the following: Shachachma lo tikras hamasubim ba'atzma. Wisdom doesn't call out to the guests to come eat from the meal, right? The wisdom themselves, right? The woman that we've been talking about, who builds this house with wisdom and understanding, she's not the one that calls out. The Torah doesn't call out, right? The Torah doesn't need to go bend over backwards to ask people to do things for it. Rak aydei narosah. It's only going to happen through the maidservants. Who are the maidservants? Ki achachma lo tavo ela adam me'atzmo. Rak tzarech lekablo mipi achachamim v'hanavim v'hamorim. We have rabbis. We have prophets. We have teachers. These are the messengers of Hashem. These are the shliachs, the shlichim of Hashem. V'heim hanaros, asher tishlach b'chol dor v'dor. Says the Malbim, these are the young maidservants, the maids that are sort of being sent into the world. Right, for some people, maybe that means the 36 tzaddikim of every generation, the lamed vav tzaddikim, right? That every generation has their teachers, has their gedolei ha'odor, that has their prophets. Ours, unfortunately, we don't really have prophets anymore. But says the Ma'abim, va'al yadam tikra al gafei merom ekares lahazmin al seuda, and it's through them with their biggest platform. Here it means to go up onto the hilltops and to scream from the hilltops all about the Torah. So that is a reference to the platform of these rabbis. You think about people like Rav Avadji Yosef, who basically had a platform to teach the entirety of Sephardic Jewry. You think about Rav Moshe Feinstein, who became the ultimate posek of 20th century America. You think about, Rav Soloveitchik and the YU dynasty. Right, you think about these characters who have these platforms. They are the maids. They are the narosah, which were sent out by Hashem to teach the people of the world, and also to teach the Jews what it means to follow, what it means to eat from this meal. And they were the ones that invited us to the meal. They say, look at the Torah, look at what it has to teach us, and that brings us in. What is the efficiency here of these maidservants? What is the efficiency brought by by these rabbis, prophets, or messengers of one kind or another. So this reminded me of another piece in Made to Stick by Chip and Dan Heath, where he talks about one of the stickiness principles is credibility. Very interesting credibility. Now, he brings up an example that he doesn't really use in the same way I'm going to use it. But credibility is basically, if you want something to make sense, it has to be credible in a way that a person can believe. So one way that a shortcut to credibility is for somebody to hear something from someone they know, to hear something from somebody who has authority, who's known as an expert on this topic or on that topic. But another way you can do that is by giving them something which they can actively, with their own eyes, with their own hands, they can tangibly experience, and that brings credibility too. And in one example, he brings the story of two medical researchers in Perth, Australia. They made an astonishing discovery in the early 1980s. They said ulcers are caused by bacteria. Now, this was not always the case. It was somewhat of a mystery. What are ulcers, you know, and how can we cure them? The researchers, Barry Marshall and Robin Warren, identified a tiny spiral-shaped type of bacteria as the culprit. The significance of this discovery was enormous. If ulcers were caused by bacteria, they could be cured. In fact, they could be cured within a matter of days by a simple treatment with antibiotics. The medical world, however, did not rejoice. There were no celebrations for Marshall and Warren, who had almost single-handedly improved the health prospects of several hundred million human beings. The reason for the lack of acclaim was simple. No one believed them. These guys were sort of, you know, low-level researchers who, you know, didn't really have any credence to their own name, and therefore no one believed what they were doing. From Australia. That's not exactly, Perth, Australia is not exactly the hotbed of scientific research. However, by 1984, Marshall's patience had run out. One morning, he skipped breakfast and asked his colleagues to meet him in the lab. While they watched in horror, he chugged a glass filled with about a billion H. pylori, which is what causes ulcers. It tasted like swamp water, he said. Within a few days, Marshall was experiencing pain, nausea, vomiting, the classic symptoms of gastritis, the early stage of an ulcer. Using an endoscope, his colleagues found that his stomach lining, previously pink and healthy, was now red and inflamed. Like a magician, Marshall then cured himself with a course of antibiotics and bismuth, the active ingredient in Pepto-Bismol. Right? So what did he do? He needed to gain credibility. How do you gain credibility? You publish an article, the article was rejected, right? No one wanted to listen to the article. It might have had some interesting experiments in it. It might have had, you know, some causation or correlation, but people weren't willing to think of it as causation, and therefore it got rejected. In a similar way, a person could look at the Torah and say, what is this book? This ancient book. Why are you giving me this Bible thing? I don't need to see this. What is there to teach me? You know, it doesn't have any credibility for me. So what do? You send in the people who have experienced it. You send in the people who really know what it is. You learn from those who live and breathe by the Torah. The same way that Marshall here took this very risky path to prove his point. He literally lived through the ulcer and lived through the medication that it was necessary to prove its credibility. The same thing is true here by the Malbim explaining Shalchan Aruch Seha, that Hashem, or wisdom, the Torah, sends forth the people who have experienced the Torah, who breathe the Torah, literally live by its messages, and a person can therefore see what the Torah can provide based on the knowledge, based on the wisdom, based on the ethics that come out of it. And that's what's going to really make it stick. Now, they weren't as successful right away. Also, even though he did this experiment, they created a momentum through this. People started to believe it, and people started to look into it. And ultimately, they won the Nobel Prize for their medical research here. But it took about 20 years for them to be recognized in that way. But by the early 90s, everyone understood from their research about how to deal with ulcers. And Baruch Hashem, I'm sure it has saved many lives and improved the health, at least, of many lives since then. We have the last two psukim, last three psukim today are really the same sort of announcement, right? The maids go out onto the hilltops, right? You can imagine the imagery, and in the analogy, it's Rav Moshe, it's Rav Soloveitchik, it's the great philosophers of Torah Judaism. So they go out into the rooftops, and what do they say? Mi pesi yasor heina. Who is simple? Come over here. Enter here. Chaser leiv amrulo. If they are devoid of a leiv, devoid of, maybe it's referring to understanding, devoid of heart. So you say to them, lechu lachamu belachmi. Another alliteration. Come eat my bread, ushesu bayayin masachti, and drink the wine that I've mixed. Izvu pesayim vechyu. Leave your simpleness or your foolishness, and you'll live. V'ishru b'derach bina, and you will, here it says, walk in the way of understanding. It could also be from the word osher. Osher could mean ennoble, right? Nobility, or wealth, prosperity of some kind. So what is this talking about? So first of all, what you see from these two analogies, the bread and the wine, again, from Pasuk Gimel. So it's interesting, last week we had a parsha, we had the pasuk, the beginning of the parsha tell us that Hashem brought us through the desert in order to teach us, it's not just, he's not just a bread machine, right? Hashem doesn't just give you bread. Lo al alechem levado yechye ha'adam. It's not just through bread that you live. Ki akom matzav hi Hashem yechye ha'adam. That what you live through is Hashem's word. So to hear, it's interesting that that the analogy is with bread, because it's saying, eat the bread, drink the wine, which means learn the Torah, learn what Hashem wants from you, much like the pasuk implied last week. The Mitzudas David says, "Im ein lachem mishel atzmeichem." If a person doesn't have food for themselves, and the analogy what that means is they don't have wisdom, they don't understand things, they don't clearly relate to the world. Bo heina v'ichlu b'lachmi, and eat my bread v'shasu hayayin and ushasu yayin, and drink the wine Hashem azakti ani. That I mixed up. Vehu inyan melitza. What's the metaphor? Lomar halo chachmas haTorah hi nechmedes miiras einayim. Right. The wisdom of the Torah is precious. It will illuminate your eyes. Vechonenes das lahalogimba. And it will graciously give over knowledge to those who are delving into it. Ukiilu machrezas v'omeres. It's as if the Torah is screaming and announcing. Kol harotze lilmod, anyone who wants to learn, yavo v'yilmod, come and learn. V'im tzafon m'libo m'seichel, ani askilu deya. And if your heart is not open to it, or it's hidden from it, so then I will teach you the wisdom. All right, Torah basically saying, I have the answers to accumulating wisdom, I have the answers to accumulating the knowledge and the intellect that you're looking for. All you have to do is come in here, come and listen, come partake in the meal that I have for you. But I wanted to look at the Malbim lastly to explain a difference in personality types. Because what we've seen thus far are two types. If you look back at Pasuk Dalet, so it said, the word Pesi, which is a simpleton, sometimes it can mean a fool, but a simpleton. And then you have a Chaser Lev, someone who's missing a heart. Right? He's devoid of either the understanding or maybe emotion. So says the Malbim, what is this talking about? You're inviting two people to the meal of Torah. One is the pesi, the simpleton, and one is the lack of the heart. A pesi is just a simpleton who never learned. Right? I once heard from Rabbi Steve Berg when he was director of NCSY. So he once said that people think that the biggest threat to the Jewish youth is that they're being distracted or they don't care about religion. He said it's not true. The biggest threat to Jewish youth is ignorance. They just don't know. So many people come to NCSY Shabbatones and it's not that they want to be irreligious. They don't have to be convinced about the Torah. They just don't know about the Torah. If someone teaches it to them in a coherent manner that gives them over the wisdom that Hashem has for life, so then they will know it. So here it's saying the pesi, the simpleton, the person who doesn't know anything. He just doesn't understand it. And never, was able to achieve or retrieve the wisdom of the Torah. kiyona posa v'chaser lev hu gam yishiyodeach hukei hachachma. And someone who is lacking of heart, the chaser lev, the other person, he actually does know wisdom. Rak shechaser lo koach hamoshel. He doesn't have the emotional strength lichvosh es yitzro to conquer his inclination, to liskabral tavosav, and to overcome his desires, vitziurav, harayim, shehem is nagdos al chukei chachma. His inclinations are leading him against the ways of the wisdom. So he knows what's right. He's not like the simple person who doesn't know. He knows what's right. Va'amra lo el apesi tomar, and he actually, the Malbim says it in different order than most say it. He says like this, lechu lachamu b'lachmi, sheikab chukei chachma, shebeze yazov derech apsios, ki achachma, he says basically first, the bread is for those who don't have any wisdom. As we started today by saying, the wisdom is just the raw material. A person who doesn't know anything, you got to start teaching him the basics. He's not going to have the greatest sense of understanding or intuition yet, but you got to teach him the basics to start. So first, that's the bread, right? As the Malbim explained before, the bread is the chachma, the wisdom. And then you say to the chaser lev, the one who is, you know, devoid of heart, right? The one who has that emotional difficulty, he can't overcome his desires. Sheutzarech lahavin omek divrei hachachma. He has to really have that intuition, as we started with today. Then in order to gain that intuition, you have to really learn more wisdom, so you can make those decisions better. That's that wine, right? That the intuition, bringing all together. The intuition is so pleasurable when you really understand, you really chop, you really sort of finally get it. And through getting the bread, and through getting the wine, these simpletons will be able to live. That the wisdom will make the simpleton or the foolishness leave from a person, and because you're going to have wisdom, v'alachaser lev, and to the one who is succumbing to his desires, shesu b'yayin masachti, come enjoy the understanding of Torah. If you finally chap it, you finally understand it, you have that intuition, that great second nature to the wisdom of the Torah, shehu. The ishru b'derech bina, that you're going to have a stride with understanding. Shayayin hu abina sheisbonunus ba'omek divrei hachachma. Right, v'az timatze osher hanefesh, and then you're going to find the nobility of the soul. B'derech shel abina v'idechem tasuru miyetzer hatayva v'ala osher v'atov. When you finally realize the wealth that's innate inside of the Torah, inside of a person who's filled with Torah, then you are going to veer off away from those desires and back towards what the Torah says is proper. I wanted to make one final point on this concept, the ishru of the Malbim. The ishru of the Malbim, the ishru, like osher, that when you follow and you finally chop the Torah and you finally understand the significance of it, that will be osher for you, will be nobility. And I think also this is a way that we can sort of look at the Torah, because oftentimes we look at it as a restricting way, in a way that basically says, you can't do this, you can't do that. But the truth is that the Torah doesn't only give us restrictions, it gives us nobility. And when you look at it that way, that the Torah is, as the Gemara says many times over, for B'nai Malachim, the Jewish people are the sons of kings and princes, the royalty. When you follow the Torah, you really become the noblest person you can. And that gives a person immense, not only pleasure through understanding the right things to do, but also purpose in life. And when you sell the Torah, when you make people understand that the Torah has nobility to offer, it gives you purpose for your life. It gives you, you know, what to follow, and it makes you feel like you're doing something worthwhile. So that's the greatest reward that a person can get. That's the greatest result of gaining wisdom, of learning Torah. And that's what it means when the Pasuk says, when Shlomo HaMelech says, presumably, Ishru b'derech bina, you will become Ish Osher, you will become wealthy, you'll become noble through the way of understanding. When you go in the way of the Torah, you will have that wealth, you'll have that nobility. So a lot of things that we went through today, but a lot of it comes down to Chachma and Bina. to understanding wisdom and understanding. You have to get the raw material, and then you have to churn it and churn it until you get finally that pleasurable bina at the end of it, that ultimate goal of intuition, of understanding the purpose, understanding the value, which is inside of all that raw material of wisdom. We talked about the concept of churning, of working through that material, working hard for a long time to get to that instantaneous decision-making possibility, to get to that intuition. We talked about improv. We talked about Tom Seaver, how while it might be difficult to go through all that chachma, to work at all of that wisdom, to really understand all that raw material, at the end of the day, it's all worth it, and all of it is really pleasurable because you know that the wine is there at the end of the day, as the Malbim explained, the pleasure at the end of when you finally chop something, when you finally get something. For Tom Seaver, when he finally pitched a good game, that was the pinnacle of all of the pleasure, the culmination of all of those journeys, when he finally reached that that peak. And then lastly, we talked about the credibility concept, that the people who go out are those who are filled with Torah. The Torah doesn't have to sell itself, because those who are filled with Torah show everyone else what kind of worthwhile and purposeful and enjoyable, pleasurable life a person can lead when they're filled with the values and ethics of the Torah. So that's the first six psukim of the ninth parak of Mishlei. The rest of the parak is going to be in some ways a contrast to the first six psukim. There are a few psukim in the middle. I don't know if we're going to go through them or we're going to sort of run through them, but we'll see Mirat Hashem next week on Monday night when we continue with the ninth parak. Okay, Shkoyach everyone.